Welcome to Babbittville Radio, a place where you'll hear great conversations with the world's best and most inspirational runner, triathletes, and cyclists. Endurance lives here. Now, here's your host, USA Triathlon and Ironman Triathlon Hall of Famer, Bob Babbitt.
Babbitt is not in studio tonight because he's playing hooky. He's joining us from his deluxe suite at an unnamed five-star resort in Phoenix. Babbitt, what are you doing right now?
I'm stranded on the way back from the Lance Armstrong Foundation weekend, doing the announcing at the Ride for the Roses, 7th annual Ride for the Roses. It's pretty amazing. They raised $4.2 million this year for cancer research, which is unbelievable.
With this one event, $4.2 million.
You know what they have? This Peloton group that raises money all year long, and some of the special perks they get if they raise over $20,000, they get flown to Austin and they ride. They do a ride with Lance and some of the legends of cycling, like Davis Finney, who is going to be our guest here momentarily.
And Bob Babbitt, I hear.
No. They don't waste their time with that loser.
Hey, Babbitt, did you actually ride?
No.
Is this like the first
Friday
weekend you haven't?
I got down in time for the big dinner on Friday night. Lyle Lovett playing for 600 of his closest friends, which was
nice.
Pretty unbelievable.
So you got there for the big dinner, which is about par for the course.
Yeah. For the food. And then today was the ride, and then was planning to be in studio tonight so we could chat with Mr. Davis Finney. And
San Diego caught on fire.
I'm here in Phoenix. But luckily, we still have one of the true legends of cycling, probably the winningest American cyclist of all time.
Not probably, Babbitt. Definitely. The winningest.
Definitely the winningest cyclist in American history. Davis Finney, who is still in Austin. Davis, how are you?
I am doing great. Thanks, guys. Yeah, you're way too generous about that winning a cyclist thing. But
what are you talking about?
You won a million races. I've seen the video.
That's true, actually. 1,342,000.
Oh, man.
For those of our listeners who don't know, Davis Finney is actually the first American to win a road stage in the Tour de France, along with, like we said, another million victories.
Yeah,
that one was a little bit bigger. If I had 1,000,000 of those, then I'd be bigger than God.
You are, Davis. You are. And for anybody who was at our competitor endurance sports awards banquet last year, they're still talking about your speech. You are bigger than God.
Well, no. Let's not go there. I'm going to get in trouble already for
Hey, so Davis, you flew in from Italy for the LAF weekend, and you've been there a number of years. How did you get? When did you start coming out for Ride for the Roses?
Well, you know, my father had a long-term battle with prostate cancer, and when Lance originated this whole idea for the Ride for the Roses and the benefit and starting the LAF Foundation, he sort of reached out to the community and said, you know, anybody who's reasonably well-known is welcome to come. And so with my dad's connection to cancer, for sure, we came down together. And we ended up having a really good experience, just my father and I. But then, you know, once you get down here and you really realize what this event is all about and the dramatic impact that it has for cancer people and their families and the LAF role in survivorship and promoting just a wealth of information on cancer issues, you just, you know, you come back. I mean, it's like you, Bob. You've been coming down here every year since I have been, too. So you know that as well as I do.
Yeah, it's just something you just can't miss. And actually, the cool part today, Huddle, here's the starting lineup on the front row at the Ride for the Roses.
Yeah.
6,500 people. Along the front line, you had Ron Kiefel, legend. Davis Finney, legend. Tyler Hamilton, legend. Obviously, Lance Armstrong. David James Elliott from JAG. Michael Ward from formerly of the Wallflowers, Grammy Award-winning guitarist. It was just like a who's who. Everybody. Oh, Ken Carpenter, two-time Olympian.
Unbelievable.
How fun was that, Davis, to be out there riding with all the boys again?
I tell you, I mean, as you guys know, I have my own little health issue with the Parkinson's, and last year when I was here, I did not feel that great. But subsequent to that, actually, you know, we've moved to Italy, as you mentioned, that I came from Italy and just lived a much lower stress life, better life, healthier life. And this year I feel great. I mean, I was out there right with the big guys the whole way. in fact, pretty much sitting on Lance's wheel. And Lance was on form today. He charged up. He was doing town sprint signs. We were motoring about 25 miles an hour. And, of course, he's sitting on the tops talking, and I'm on the drops going about as hard as I can. But it was a blast. I mean, it just felt so good, and I felt better and better just throughout the whole ride being with those guys and sort of psychologically kind of feeling like I used to feel back in the day. And, you know, it was, I mean, this weekend even for me was pure medicine. And, I mean, I had a really good time. And as you said, Bob, not just the ride, but having Lyle Lovett play a private concert for the people who raised the most money. And it was just an exceptional weekend. And the one thing I got to say is the guy, as always, who was most impressive was Lance himself. I mean, he is just magic, and he is, you know, we've always said how much he's done and what he's done with his comeback from cancer and his name and notoriety, but he is so comfortable in the public now, and he is just so fun and funny, and I mean, he's just fabulous, and I mean, my hat's off to the guy, as it always has been for ever since he came back, but even more so now. And I would just really recommend anyone who wants to do something good for cancer that they get involved with the LAF or try to make this event next year.
So, Davis, you're telling me that that Lance actually won some of these sprints with you on his wheel? I think you were letting him have these things, right?
No,
I
mean, man.
You got a lot more fast twitch than that guy.
I tell you, there was a stiff crosswind, and I mean, I didn't want to hurt his feelings or anything.
Exactly.
So. You know, I didn't want him to go into trying for win number six in the tour and think he got beat by some guy who's been retired for 20 years. So I had to give him something.
You could have yelled over to Kiefel to pull you out.
Yeah, exactly. I was going to say, your old teammate.
No, you know, Kiefel took out two of them.
Yeah,
Kiefel, nicknamed Wookie.
You know, Wookie.
He's this big Wookie bear.
He is a big guy now.
He's about 200 pounds now. So
nice.
But he carries it well. He gets that gear rolling, and the big Wook man is up there pounding. But, you know, as I said to Lance, I'd say, you know, Lance would try to pull in behind Ron, and I'd be like, hey, this is my wheel. I'm the only guy who gets to follow Ron Kiefel around.
I've had this wheel for 20 years. Get out of here.
Exactly. I don't care how many tours you've won. This is my wheel.
Davis, how was it to ride with Ron and ride with one of your old teammates?
Oh, man, it was a blast. I mean, you know, there's that. I remember last time I was on the show with you guys talking about the hand in glove feeling of having a good teammate, and anybody who's raced the bike certainly knows what it's like to have someone lead you around and put you in perfect position for the sprint. And Ron was that guy for me. And I mean, he could just dial it up like you could not believe. And all I had to do was stay glued to his rear wheel and stay right behind him. And getting on his wheel today, I felt like I was back home in a sense. And literally, you know, I mean, I do have some problems pedaling with this Parkinson's, but just as soon as I grooved into Ron's wheel, something kicked into my brain that got me working and functioning better. So it was truly a magic moment for me to be able to be a part of the ride and ride with all those guys. And Tyler, I mean, Tyler is a great guy, and it's just so neat to see everybody out there and supporting the ride and being able to be up there and almost hammer with them.
Hey, Davis, Tyler didn't crash, did he?
No,
that was funny. Lance was
you know what? The funny thing is, Tyler gets kind of a bad rap for his crashes. I mean, I probably crashed like 100 times more than Tyler. I just have thicker bones, you know. I'm kind of a numbskull, so he's just a little too fragile. The one or two times he falls down, he always breaks something. But I think that's part of the Tyler story. Is you know, it's like, okay, I got the IMAX crew. I got to do something dramatic. So let me just fall down, break my collarbone, and stay into the whole tour, and then win a stage and get third overall.
Yeah.
No problem.
Well, it's funny when Lance was on a couple weeks ago, he talked about it. He says, yeah, you know, Tyler falls down, we'd be riding to a time trial and he'd fall down. I mean, the guy would just, he'd fall down in the parking lot. He just, for whatever reason, he ends up on the ground more often than not.
Ron said that about me?
No.
Lance was saying this about Tyler.
About Tyler when they were
yeah,
teammates.
Oh, yeah. No. Tyler, it's one thing about that comes from having started his career later.
Right.
And, you know, and despite being a downhill skier and whatnot, I mean, he did not really start seriously racing a bike until he was around 20 years old. And I do think that there is an innate sense you gain from racing, or whether it's BMX or mountain biking, or getting into road riding at somewhat of a serious level, just a little bit younger that might preclude having the kind of accidents he has.
Yeah, again, we're speaking with Davis Finney, one of the legends of cycling. And Davis, when speaking of getting started in cycling, how old were you when you got going?
I was 15.
And did you know right away this is my sport?
I don't know if I knew right away, but I think that I was somewhat typically disenchanted with things at that age. You know, a little bit troubled with school, getting in trouble and sort of heading in the wrong direction and disengaged with my parents fairly much and needing something to give me direction. And I had tried a lot of sports and been fairly good at things, but, you know, kind of always ran into a ceiling pretty quick and didn't really understand how to get through it. But with cycling, it was just the right thing at the right time. And I saw the bike race in Boulder, the old Red Zinger.
Red Zinger, yeah.
And I just said, man, I wrote home and I said, Dad, I want to be a bike racer.
And your dad goes, what's that?
Yeah, exactly. Your dad's like, what?
You know, well, my dad's like, great.
Golf, tennis, yes. Yeah. Cycling,
yeah.
What?
that's the thing, because back then it was well into my pro career where he was a little less worrisome about my future. But all along, he's just like going, you're never going to be able to make a future as a pro bike racer, pal.
Now, speaking of that, when did you realize or think, you know what, I could make a living at this?
Well, I don't know if there was a point when I noted that I could make a living at this, but I do have, I have a clipping from the Boulder Daily Camera from when I was 18 and just graduated from high school, and it says, you know, BHS grad dreams of pro career. And it has this picture of this chubby-faced kid looking off into the horizon. So I definitely had it in the back of my mind. You know, you say the thing that you want to do, and whether you believe it or not is a different thing. But I think sometimes you just need to keep telling yourself, this is what I can do. And after a time, you come to believe in it, and you come to believe in yourself. And that's, I think that's important for people to have dreams. And despite certain setbacks that you will get, you know, if you keep that dream going and you keep telling yourself, I can do this and I will do this, you can often make that dream come true. And in my case, that was certainly became apparent that I had the possibilities to do it.
So, Davis, at the age of 18, you're dreaming of becoming a pro cyclist. At what age do you feel like you truly were a pro cyclist? You were supporting yourself and doing well as a pro cyclist.
Well, you know, it was, I mean, I 18, I was racing for gas money, trying to win premiums and making almost no money working in the winter in restaurants. And, I don't know, 1920, I started to get a little bits of sponsorship, but I don't know. It was probably when I was 21, 22, we had my first somewhat significant sponsorship, and it was about $5,000 for the year.
Yeah, baby.
Not including expenses. I don't know if you can qualify that as being a professional.
Wow.
That's huge.
But I think, you know, when I got with 7-Eleven in 1982, was when I really felt like, you know, I'm on the right track here, because that was a very professional organization, and, you know, I was paid a whopping $12,000.
Woo!
But you know, all my expenses were paid. I got to every race. I won about 30 races that year. And, you know, I started to feel like, okay, now the dream is starting to become realistic.
Davis, when you made the 7-Eleven team, or chosen for that 7-Eleven team, did you
did you know a lot of the guys who were on that team? Had you been having some good head-to-head battles with a lot of these guys?
Well, yeah, because, you know, the team was originated the year before, and Ron Kiefel and I were both invited to be on the program, but there was a very restrictive contract that you had to sign with a New York agent who'd been involved with Jim Okowitz in the discussions to originate the team, and I just didn't feel like I wanted to sign a three-year, sign my lifetime rights away to this guy, and just to be on this team. So we declined to be on the team, and then, of course, we spent the next year just battling this pitch battle of, you know, us, like, practically hitchhiking to races, and these guys driving or getting flown to every race and driving up in this beautiful van and, you know, coming out with all this new equipment, and we're on, like, borrowed parts and stuff. And so Ron would look at me and he goes, why did you talk me out of joining this team? So anyway, but we were certainly competitive enough with them, and they were good friends of ours. But, you know, they had numbers, they had organization, and they also had, you know, there's just something about it. It's like the New York Yankees. I mean, although we saw they could be beat in general, you know, when they hit the field, they just have the legacy and they have the attitude, and I think that that's a lot of what 7-Eleven had in their program. And when Ron and I joined the team, I think we really just only enhanced that. And I know for my own sake, I went into every single race that I rode in those days anticipating winning it. And not only that, it was an anticipation of not just winning but sweeping if we could, 1, 2, 3. And I always got on the line, you know, as I've told you guys, basically looking around at everybody with the look like, okay, well, you guys figure out who's going to get second.
Actually, I remember when we were talking one time, you mentioned how at a crit or any of those races that when they would line up that you would come in from the other direction and sort of make room for you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that was back. I mean, you know, if anybody's been to a Criterium knows what it's like, this sort of franticness of being close to the start line so you can get on the front of the line, and the officials are holding everybody back, and there's this big scrum to get up there, and it's just this pitch battle, and everybody's all nervous. And I would just completely lay out of that, ride around the course backwards, and roll up the start line where everybody's just completely jammed into the bar to bar, and just sort of turn my bike around and say, excuse me, I need to be right here.
Excuse me, the winner needs a space.
And those guys just used to hate me for that.
Now, Davis, they hated you for it, but didn't any of the other guys figure it out and go, you know what, I'm going to do what Davis does next week?
Well, you know, the reason that they didn't do that was because the officials, I mean, you know how to work the system, and
yeah.
I was always very friendly with the officials. I was always up on the podium. I was always on the PA. I was always complimenting the race organizer and the crowd. And so, I mean, the officials were kind of on my side. And then it was in general, I'd end up winning the race anyway. So they just sort of, everybody sort of played along with the game with me and let it work in my favor. But I think that's a lot of what being a really good athlete is about. It's not just about doing the training and showing up and saying, I'm fit and ready to win this race. It's the whole protocol of figuring out how everybody's psychology works and, you know, how to make it work for you. And that includes the whole political process of being a part of an event. And, I mean, you know, you guys know, you've been competitors and you run events and you know you cater to your stars. And you cater to the people that work and make your event look good.
Right.
Davis, you've been living in Italy. You've been to Europe a lot. And we're accustomed to seeing the U.S. Postal Team in Europe, a lot of American riders in Europe. But when 7-Eleven went over to the tour for that first time, tell us a little bit about what that was like. How was the acceptance? And, you know, just how hard was that?
Yeah, it was an interesting experience. You know, I've been my roommate for this weekend's Jim Okowitz, the guy who originated the 7-Eleven team, and we were talking a little bit about the old days just through the weekend. And one thing that was kind of remarkable was just sort of the moxie, to use a term that we had, to think that we could just turn this bunch of American amateurs into a pro team and just show up in Europe and start racing. And yet that's what we did. And it was, I mean, by hook or by crook, I remember the first race we went to in France in 1985 as a team, people were just looking at us like, who in the world are you guys? And wherever you're from, you probably need to go back there because you just don't look like you belong here. And I just remember being in this hotel with all this sort of fancy hotel at this event called the Trois de Bessèges in southern France. And all these teams are getting service and everybody's getting their food. And we just, like they're not even paying us any attention. And so we're like, ouch, you know, Jim Ockwood's nickname, we're like, ouch, ouch. You got to tip the maitre d'. I got to tip the maitre d'. So, oh, she's like, pulls out like a, you know, 100-franc note, you know, like some obscene amount of money. And he walks over to the maitre d' and he kind of slips and he goes, you know, très bien, merci, au revoir. Three words of French he knows and he says them pretty badly. And he goes, you know, take this and please serve us. And I swear to gosh, it didn't do anything. We still never got served. But the guy went home and had a big laugh over the idiotic Americans. But that was just kind of the way it was. We just didn't know what we were doing. And yet somehow, in fact, Jim told the story just the other night, but that within a month of us being in Europe, they had the race they call the season opener in Italy, the Trofeo Liguria. And, you know, we went there again, just it was one of our first forays into Italy, and they were just, they had no idea who we were or what we were about and who this, what this 7-Eleven jersey was. And yet, with 5Ks to go, we hit the final hill, and the field's pretty diminished. It's a tough race. It's a big event to win for the Italians. And Ron Kiefel just does a Wookiee monstrous hill attack, buries the field, takes off with the Italian national champion on his wheel, pulls him to the line, and the guy can't get past him. And then Wookiee wins his first pro race in the season opener for Italy. And the Italians were just like, oh, my goodness.
What have we started?
You know?
Wow.
And it just went from there. I mean, you know, and we got into the Tour of Italy then, and Ron won a stage, and Andy won a stage, Andy Hampson. And Bob Roll was on our team just by a fluke, flown in the last day, and that started his pro career. It was just sort of this magical time where we were racing in like suspended animation because we just seemed to be able to do things that had never been done before, and people couldn't understand how we could do it. You know, it was like Alex Spida on the first day of the following year in our first Tour de France, who gets every single leader's jersey on the first stage. You know, in an orchestration of a solo breakaway that had never ever been done and will never be done again.
God.
Yeah, I cannot imagine. I mean, I know you guys, you know, at the time knew what you were up against with the history and the tradition that you were coming into. I mean, I can't imagine like a Belgian professional football team just joining the NFL.
Yeah, you know? Exactly. And that's a really good analogy because that's about what it was like. In terms of the way the NFL would receive those guys, they would just laugh their butts off at them, and that's what we were. We felt like we were trying to get into a men's club that was just going, you know, sorry, but you guys are too young and you don't know how to play our game.
Well, and not only that, Davis, but if you think about it, your strength was criteriums. Your strength was circuit races, and Europe is not famous for that. I mean, you talk about a little bit of a fish out of water. This was a different style of racing for you, right?
Yeah, big time fish out of water. Well, I was very fast and naturally quick, but over distance, I definitely struggled, and it took me a lot of years to be able to get the stamina to sprint even reasonably well. Over 100 miles, and then over 120 miles, 130 miles, and so I always said Tour de France was made up of criteriums. I had won the Tour de France like 10 times straight, but
right.
Fortunately, they don't run criteriums in the Tour.
Now, Davis, one of the times you were on with us, you told us this great story about, yeah, it was great to win some stages of the Tour, but there was one stage where you needed to finish within a certain time frame just to stay in the Tour.
Yeah.
And it didn't seem like there was any way that was going to happen.
Well, that's a defining moment of my career, and in fact, one of the principals of the LAF asked me what my greatest victory was as a cyclist, and I told him that the story of being in the 1990 Tour, the last Tour that I rode, and not being prepared to ride the Tour because my son was going to be born, and opting out of the spring build-up program and not being ready, but then my son got born 3 days before the event. Jim Ockworth calls, says, "Hey, that's great. You want to come over?" And I got to the Tour the night before the prologue.
Oh, God.
And just for the reason that they were saying, you know, just ride 10 days, give us some good sprint finishes, keep the team morale up, and you'll be good to go home. And that's what I told Connie, my wife, who had agreed to let me go as long as I came home after 10 days. But in the back of my mind, I just never wanted to quit bike races. I hated the idea of quitting. So I was pretty much intending to just finish. But after 10 days, I'd had some good sprint finishes, but I was starting to get really tired because Steve Bauer, our teammate, had the leader's jersey for the first 10 days and had this, you know, magnificent run. And so we did a lot of work for him. And so I was getting more and more tired. But then, of course, after 10 days, you hit the mountains. And I had 2 days into the Alps with 1 day to go, and I was just so completely drained and had just seemingly nothing in my legs. And yet I faced the stage, the vaunted El Tuez, with three major climbs before it and about 230K stage.
Oh.
And so, you know, I start out the day and I struggle over the first climb. And then at the bottom of the second climb, the Col de Madeleine, I get dropped within 100 meters of the road tilting up. And the sign says, you know, it's only 27K to the top.
Oh, my God.
So I'm like, oh, no, you know, and I'm just fighting and dying. I'm just dying so bad to get up the hill. And at the very top of the mountain, I'm 20 minutes down, and I'm dead last in the bike race. And I'm thinking, okay, well, 20 minutes, this is going to be about a seven-hour race. That gives me about 40 minutes for the time limit total to be behind the winner. And, of course, that's what makes the Tour de France tough, is not that you have to ride the distance, but that you have to ride the distance within a very close proximity to the leaders or else you're out. And that's what the time limit's all about. And so I figured I had about 40 minutes to work with. Here I am faced with 100K to go. I'm 20 minutes down, and I've got two major passes, two of the biggest climbs in Europe, to go by myself.
Oh.
Felt like I'm done. You know, I'm not going to make it. And I got down to the bottom of the hill, you know, a little bit melancholy, but also fairly relaxed, figuring, well, I made 13 days after 10, you know, trying to justify quitting. And I got to the feed zone. I thought, well, I'll just get in the car here, and that'll be it. But when I went down the row of cars, I'm looking, and I'm looking, and I'm looking, and there's no 7-Eleven car. And I'm like, God, the guys didn't even wait for me to quit. and yet, just at the last of the cars, this arm comes out and swings out a bag that says 7-Eleven on it, and I just grab it, keep going, put it over my shoulder, turn the corner, head up to Glendon, and say, and I'm thinking, that was stupid, you know? Why don't I just get in the car? But I just couldn't do it. I couldn't quit. And so I ate some food, ate some power bars, drank a Coca-Cola, and just sort of kept going up this hill. And as I was going up the hill, it just sort of came to me that, you know, maybe this is my mission for my career right now. Maybe 20 years of bike racing and bike riding and training when it's nasty out and when nobody else will go out, maybe it kind of comes to this, that I'm going to just give everything I absolutely can to go the next 80 kilometers flat out, and I'm going to make that time limit. And so I just gave myself the mission. And I headed up the Col de Glendon, which is another brutal climb. But, you know, towards the top, there's people up there, and they see a rider, and the great thing about the Tour is everybody cheers for the first to last rider, and I'm last, but I'm still a pro, and I'm still in the Tour, and they're still cheering for me, and so you start to get energy for that. And I saw this rider that I was slowly catching up to, and I'm thinking, okay, I got one guy. If I can just catch that guy, then it's two of us together, and we're going to make it. I got another guy to help me, and sure enough, right by the top, I catch this Spanish rider, and I look over, and he's looking pretty fried, but he sees me, and so I'm like, you know, in Italian, because I don't know Spanish as well. I just said, you know, andiamo, andiamo, andiamo insieme, let's go together. And he's like, see, Testos, yeah, certainly. And so he jumps on my wheel. We go over the top of a gendarme motorcycle, pulls out, and I'm like, yeah, all right, two guys, we got a gendarme. I'm getting my morale back. I'm ready to go. And I'm just going to turn down, putting the gears bigger, starting to roll it out. I hear this bang. I look back. The Spanish guy's tire's flat as he stops. I never see him again. The motorcycle stops. I never see him again.
Oh, no.
I'm back all by myself in somewhere in France. So then I got to recover my morale, you know, but I just go back to the thing. I got the mission, you know. This is what it's all about. I got to put it all into this ride and get everything out of myself. And I dropped down the hill like an absolute stone. I hit 110 kilometers an hour, fastest I've ever gone in Europe. And I'm just, like, fighting my hands not to grab the brakes, but I'm like, no, every second. And I get off the bottom of the hill, roll up the valley toward the Alpe d'Huez, and hit the bottom of that climb, and it's brutal because you go from 30 miles an hour to 5 because the road goes straight into a 20% grade. And yet, you know, I'm just like, I'm on a mission, and I'm starting to, I can't even feel my legs at this point, and I'm just going up the hill as hard as I can. But the beauty of the Alp is that 300,000 people go up that hill to watch. And even though Lamont and Bugno battled out the stage wins, you know, a long time ahead of me, they're long gone, and people are starting to pack up their car. They hear the crowd noise of another rider coming, and the people above them stop putting their stuff away, and they come back out on the road. And by the last 5K, the road was completely closed with people, and I picked up a motorcycle finally. And I'm just following this motorcycle, and the sea of people just parts in front of the motorcycle, and water's pouring over my head, and people are screaming, allez, allez, hop, 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 die, you know, vous allez, like five languages, you know, all at once. And it's so loud and so deafening and so hot, and this cacophony of noise, it's just incredible. I mean, it still gives me goosebumps to think about being in that little vortex of energy you get from the people. And I'm just totally, I can't even think. I'm just so gassed, and I'm giving everything to get to the top of the hill. And right before the top of the Alp, you have a little descent, and then you take a left-hand turn, and you come about 300 meters up a small incline to the finish. And as I come around that left-hander, I look up, and they're tearing down the scaffolding at the finish line.
Oh, my God.
And I was like going, oh, I'm done. I missed it. I blew it. And I just completely deflated. But I sprinted across the line. And the one guy that waited for me after all this time was Jim Okowitz. And I just rode right into him and just collapsed. I mean, I was completely done. It was the hardest day I'd ever done on my bike and the hardest effort I've ever given. And I just sat there and I just breathed and tried to recover. And he put a towel around my neck. And finally, after a few minutes, he just leans into my ear and he just says, 2 minutes. You made it by 2 minutes.
Oh, my God.
So for me, that was the biggest victory.
That is great.
Hey, Davis, can you hang out for a minute or two while we pay some bills here?
Yeah, I only overran your commercial time.
No. That was a great, love that story.
Okay,
all right, this is The Competitors, brought to you by Rubio's, Jamba Juice, DegreeIronMan.com, and Competitor.com. Hold on, we'll be right back with Davis Finney.
Multisports.com is the industry leader in triathlon coaching, camps, and clinics. Whether you're an Ironman veteran, a beginner wanting to complete your first sprint race, or you want to go off-road, we have the people and the programs to get you there. Multisports.com features a staff that includes 8-time Ironman champion Paul Newby Frazier, Heather Fuhrer, Tim DeBoom, Chris Lee, super coaches Paul Huddle and Rock Fry, and ex-Terra star Jimmy Riccitiello. We have the program to help you reach your goals. Call us at 760-635-1795 or check us out at multisports.com. That's multisports.com. Call us today.
Have you been injured in an automobile accident or while riding your bike? If so, then call the law firm of Richard Duquette, 1-800-464-4123. Mr. Duquette is the former sponsor of the Attorney for Athletes triathlon team and a two-time Ironman, so he understands your active sports lifestyle. He offers a free consultation and is conveniently located just off the 5 Freeway in Carlsbad, between Tamarack and Carlsbad Village Drive. See their website, 911law.com, for free information on how to protect your rights until you see an attorney and read what their past clients have to say. Mr. Duquette has over 20 years of experience and will work hard to help you through this difficult time. Call 1-800-464-4123 today.
XEPRS 1090 AM Rosarito, Baja California.
Express Sports Talk Radio for San Diego, the mighty 1090.
Once a safe harbor for pirates, Cabo San Lucas at Baja California's southernmost tip has grown from a small fishing village to a vacation paradise. Where the Pacific Ocean meets the Sea of Cortez, you'll find Mexico's natural beauty on display. Whether you enjoy golf, swimming, sailing, surfing, whale watching, or just relaxing on their pristine beaches, Cabo offers more fun in the sun and quite an exciting nightlife. With first-rate dining and accommodations and so much to see and do, Cabo should be your next vacation destination. The Mexican Tourism Board invites you to visit Baja California.
Ready to reach your top speed? Top Speed Running in La Verne carries all your favorite brands like Hines, Brooks, and Asics, serving the East San Gabriel Valley and Inland Empire. The store is conveniently located on the northwest corner of Foothill and Wheeler. Exit the 210 freeway at Foothill and travel east to 1371 Foothill Boulevard. Top Speed Running will get you on the move in a hurry. Gear up for all your favorite events with the top service and advice from experts at Top Speed Running. Stop by at 1371 Foothill Boulevard in La Verne or call them today at 909-593-7400. That's 909-593-7400.
Are you ready to get off that couch and get in shape? Whether you're looking to train for a marathon or just a beginner, 24 Hour Fitness has the great facilities to help you make the most of your workout. Forget your paranoid fantasies about an intimidating gym. At 24 Hour Fitness, you'll find all sorts of people working out with you, and there's always a friendly professional to help. We even have month-to-month memberships available. Call 1-800-204-2400 to get started. It's the way we make you feel. Facilities and amenities may vary per location. Not all clubs open 24 hours every day.
The Red and Black are coming.
This is Coach Tom Kraft of the San Diego State Aztecs, and you're listening to the Mighty 1090, the new home of San Diego State University.
When you go back to the tour, which you do every year, what surprises you? What changes have you seen in the cyclists and in the sport itself?
Well, I mean, I think I witnessed the change, a dramatic change in the sport in the early 90s. I saw the speeds of the Tour de France immediately come up in 91 and 92, and it was usually the same group of riders that had the same doctors were dominating. Honestly,
and
it was shocking, the difference. I mean, can you imagine? I won the Tour de France in 1990. My team won the team classification, and it's 2 years and 3 years later, we weren't capable of finishing riders in the Tour de France. And my problem is not that. I had a health problem, but I think the introduction of EPO, growth hormone, testosterone into the peloton at that time in a scientific way elevated the speeds, and if you weren't on it, you weren't competing. You weren't competitive.
Welcome back to the competitors. My name is Paul Huddle. His name is Bob Abbott. We're brought to you every week by Rubio's, Jamba Juice, DegreeIronman.com, and Competitor.com. And joining us this evening is the United States Bicycling Hall of Fame member and, 300 national and international Category 1 pro victories, Davis Finney.
Oof.
How do you like that?
See, he's got the real number, Davis.
328.
Ah, see that? I forgot to put over on the front end of that. Over 300.
Oh, my God. Huddle, how could you do that?
I know.
I can't believe that.
I love that. 328. Yeah, 328. That's awesome.
Good. Davis, when you first went to Europe, dealing with European media and dealing with some of the European riders, how long did it take before you guys got some respect in the peloton?
Well, I would say,
it came in fits and starts. You know, certainly when we had success in the Tour of Italy, then in Italy we started to get respect. But we were always the scapegoat for anybody crashing. They go, "Oh, Dio Bono, Americano, sempre Americani." You know, it's always the Americans.
And Tyler wasn't even there at that point.
Yeah.
Really. Poor Tyler. Anyway, but no, it just was in fits and starts. And I think that, you know, in 86, I mean, Alex got the jersey. I won a stage on the second day of that tour. And then they were really dumbfounded by that, the Europeans. But then we struggled, and we definitely, you know, I think we only finished five riders in that very first Tour de France. But slowly and yet surely we gained our place. And I would say it was probably 2 years, a good 2 years before we had a reasonable amount of respect. But and then by 87, we had Andy Hampson on the team, and he won the Tour of Switzerland. And then, of course, by 88, he won the Tour of Italy, and is still the only American to do that. And so we really felt like we had arrived at that point.
Davis, talk a little bit about some of the sprinters that are out there now. I think some of the best-known cyclists in the world, certainly in Europe, are Eric Zabel, Mario Cipollini, and McEwen, O'Grady, and now Pataki. Talk a little bit about all those guys and how hard is it to stay at the top of that game? I mean, especially as you get older, it seems like, you know, being able to go fast and keep up with these young guys gets harder and harder.
I mean, you know how it is, Paul.
I don't actually, but
no, but you know, I mean, you know how your muscle constitution changes over time when you're training and racing year in and year out. And what's really remarkable for me is a guy like Mario Cipollini, that, I mean, he's been in the sport 14 years, and he's still considered, you know, if not the best, one of the two or three best sprinters in the world. And so he is just incredible, because the speeds that the guys sprint at is much more, I'd say it's a good 5 kilometers an hour faster than what I had to deal with. And they're using, you know, they're in a sprinting, they're pushing these enormous 53, 54, 11, tooth cogs at about 70 kilometers an hour, like over 40 miles an hour for the last kilometer. And it's just unreal, the speeds they carry. And part of that is also the lead out is stronger, the teams are more organized. Cipollini has a great team, Pataki has a great team. You know, but it's great fun. I mean, I think that the sprints really enliven the spectacle of watching or an event like the Tour de France. You know, it's part and parcel with the sport, that you have days where certain guys do well and days where other guys do well, and the sprinters just are so entertaining.
It's unbelievable.
You and like banging around with Zabel and smashing bars, and they're all fighting for the wheel, and then you watch Pataki and Cipollini last year, and they make it look so easy, because they just sit like smooth as glass up behind a perfect lead-out train. Nobody hassles them.
No.
And then they go from 200 meters. And what people don't understand is that to try to get around a guy like Pataki, who's going 70 kilometers an hour, and get by him within a 10-second window, you have to be going 72 kilometers an hour. And so once you come off that wheel, you have to go faster than he's going to pass him, and people are like, well, why don't you just go around him? And I'm like, well, why don't you just try to come around a bus and stick your hand out the window at 40 miles an hour and feel how much resistance you have.
Davis, looking back to the early 90s when you had your first look at a young Lance Armstrong, what were your thoughts?
Lance has just always been exceptional, and you know, it's funny, I had a great conversation with his mother, Linda, today, who was out at the race, and she was introducing to me somebody, and she was going, oh, I remember when Lance was just up to here on you, and I go, no, Linda, he was always taller than me. I was just a lot older. And she goes, well, yeah, I guess that's true. And I'm like, wait a minute, you're not supposed to say that, you're not supposed to agree to that. But, no, when he was, I mean, you know, he was a guy, as you guys know, who was very strong in triathlon. And in fact, Bob, we should mention that Lance, who has not run one step in a year, ran a 5K yesterday in 18 minutes.
Yeah, he ran like 18 flat huddle, just jumped into the 5K in his board shoes.
And I talked to him right afterwards, and I said, I can't believe you did that. When did you run? And he goes, I haven't run for a year, but I just felt like I should do it. So I started out with a 6-minute mile, then I ran a 5:30. But then I kind of had it started to catch up with me.
Yeah.
And he was pissed.
Yeah.
He was like, I should have gone faster.
Yeah. Yeah. And when, in the first part of the run, he was sort of jogging along with some of the celeb characters, and then he took off. So who knows how fast that guy can run.
But so he just has the genetic wonder capacity that is very, very rare. And when I was towards the end of my career, I was still pretty good. But he was like Lamont. He was just so superior, and you just knew that you were around somebody really special. And, I mean, the story I probably told you guys before on the show is just being in the U.S. Pro Championships in my last year of racing in 93, and we're going up the wall, as they call it in Philadelphia.
Right.
It's a pretty brutal climb, and you have to do it about 10 times. And we're on about our eighth or ninth time. And everybody is there who's the best riders of the day. And we're all looking at each other, and we're sprinting up this thing in like a 39.17, 39.16 gearing. And Lance comes rolling by, and we are going absolutely flat out. We know it's going to go on this lap. The brakes are going to go. And Lance goes right by us, and he gives us that look he gave Ulrich, and he just starts sprinting. And he is just gone.
Wow.
And right at that moment, I just thought to myself, I've seen the future, and I'm not in it.
And there it goes.
Hey, Davis, when you see what Lance has done now, I mean, you may not have thought he was going to win five tours back then. You knew he was going to be great. But this year, I think some people finally saw, at least I think the guys in the Peloton saw, hey, maybe Lance is human. And I think it also shows not just how difficult it is to win one, you know, five tours, but just one tour is huge. How huge is it? I mean, he's won five tours in a row. And I know, Indurain is fairly recent history and did it as well. But how hard is number six going to be, and how big is it that he's already done number five?
Yeah, well, it's enormous. And it's incredible. And to me, it really points out a couple things about the tour itself, because no other race in history has just a few names that have won so many times. And it really shows the single characteristic that the greatest cyclists of the day are able to dominate the one hardest race. And everybody says, oh, Lance should do the Giro, or Lance should do this, or Simone could win the tour, and he won the Giro, and yada, yada, yada. But all the pretenders come to the tour every year, and they all fold and just blow away in the wind. And it's always the same guys. You know, it's always Ulrich and it's always Lance who are up there, and Lance ends up winning. And so it's a very interesting stat to me that four guys have won 20 tours between them. And yet Lance being one of them and being an American is just so remarkable. But I'll tell you what, guys. Number six, breaking the record of all time, breaking all those legends' records, breaking Eddie Merckx's record, Indurain, Anquetil, and Hino. Are you kidding? You think the whole world, the whole European world, ain't going to be against him?
Right.
But here's what Lance learned, what he admits he learned this year. He was getting soft. He was taking it for granted. He had some difficulties, personal difficulties in the off season. He didn't get his base in. Yet he still felt confident going into the race. And he just had, you know, one of those years where everything goes wrong. And I think in his heart of hearts, he felt like, geez, you know, I could lose this thing.
Right.
And that was the first time that has happened to him, because he's been almost coasting the victories. In Lance parlance, you know, it had been easy, you know, but for anybody else, that ain't so. But I think what it really confirmed to him is that it isn't easy. And that he has to go back to, again, in his words, being a monk and shutting out the world from January 1 on, and just putting paid to the effort that he needs to put in to be there. And I guarantee you, the guy who shows up on the line next year is going to be the best guy we've ever seen, and it's going to be really, really tough to beat him.
Based on the guys who we've seen this last tour, I mean, I would guess that people like Bilocchi and even Ulrich and Vino, these guys are like thinking, God, we finally saw a chink in this guy's armor. This is going to be the year. Who of these guys do you feel like, I mean, is it still just Ulrich, or are there now another three, four, five guys who have a shot?
No, it's just Ulrich.
Yeah.
I mean, he's really the guy, and he's, and then Lance says the same. There's one guy who's going to win the race if it's not him, and it's Jan Ulrich. But in saying that, there is a lot of quality of guys who are very close to that. Tyler Hamilton's one of those guys.
Yeah.
You know, Bilocchi, Eusebio Bilocchi from Spain is one of those guys.
Vinokourov.
Yeah. Or however you say it. Yeah. No, you say it, Paul.
Vinokourov, yeah.
Vinokourov, that's it. And, you know, so there's people who can ride to that level. But in general, when those guys get in the position to win, it's a lot different being Vinokourov and trying to take out time from Lance when he's not really worried about you.
Right.
And getting up to third overall than being in the lead and defending
the
lead.
Yeah.
And, you know,
and
but it's
team.
An it's they just announced the route on Friday, and it's an interesting race this year. I mean, they put a lot of the race into the last week. They have Alpe d'Huez as a time trial. They've never had a serious uphill time trial before in the Tour ever. Now they got a 15-kilometer time trial up Alpe d'Huez. And so I think they're trying to find a way not to make Lance lose, but to just make it a really different race and give some of these riders who have extreme specialties, some of the real strong climbers, an opportunity to maybe do something to have a different result. But I don't think it'll happen. I mean, Lance is so smart, and he's so good at what he does. And the best thing that could happen to him this year was to almost lose.
Right.
And that's where everybody may say, they're maybe thinking, well, Lance is human. But I tell you what, he's about to go back into, my opinion, he's about to go back into superhuman category.
Yeah.
He's pissed now. He's pissed that it got that close.
Yeah. I mean, he's pissed. He says it. He goes, I'm mad again. And I race best when I'm mad. And, you know, I mean, it's going to be awesome. It's going to be a great spectacle in the history of sports that one man who comes from a country where a minimum of people are involved in this sport is going to be the greatest of all time tour riders. It's really, really special and really spectacular.
Hey, Davis, one of the things that really interested, I think, a lot of people this year, maybe from sort of a NASCAR car crash kind of point of view, was that first stage where the sprinters came in to the last kilometer, and they, I believe they had a turn about 400 meters before the line. How much, you know, when everyone saw that crash, there was a lot of blaming going around. Everyone said, well, it was the organizer. They put a turn too close to the finish. And then other people were saying, these guys are pro cyclists. These guys need to know the finish and know what's going to be happening and handle their bikes appropriately.
Yeah. I mean, that's a difficult call. You know, the organizers always get criticized, and it's almost impossible to have a perfect finish when you move from town to town year to year. What's happened is now there's so much pressure on so many riders to try to get a stage win. And what I believe that the root of the problem is that too many of the GC riders are trying to stack up in the front where they don't need to be in the final kilometer because they're afraid they're going to get in a crash and lose time. But what they need to do is move back the line where they don't where you don't lose time if you get in a crash. In right as it stands, if you get in a crash in the final K, the final kilometer, you don't lose. You come in with the winner's time if you're with that group at the time of the crash.
Right.
Right.
So what they need to do is bump that back to 2 or 3 K on the stages where nobody would get dropped for any reason to that point anyway, and just take some pressure off the front of that group. I mean, that's why Tyler crashed. Lance was in that crash.
Yeah.
You know, those guys are riding top 30, and when you got 15 or 20 guys who are contending for the overall, mixing it up with 30 or 40 riders who have, you know, there's 10 sprinters, and then each of those sprinters has 2 or 3 guys trying to help them, and then you got the occasional guy who's trying to make that last 500 meters to go attack, and it's just too many riders who are risking too much to be in the same small space on the road. And they just need to take some pressure off that by taking the GC riders out of that equation and letting them come in just at the back of the group.
Yeah.
Hey, Davis, I know we're probably running a little short of time, but you were one of the first guys to really ride with the top triathletes, with Mark Allen and Scott Tinley and Scott Molina and Dave Scott. Were you surprised at their prowess on the bike when you first met them?
Well, you know, I mean, I don't know that I'd say I was surprised. I was actually mostly surprised with the triathletes as a whole at how little they really paid attention to the technique of riding.
Right.
And they were just like these just incessant hammerheads. You know, I mean, Paul knows, you get out with that boulder group and they'd be like 5 feet apart all over the road going flat out every time they got on the bike.
Right.
And
with Huddle leading the way.
So what are you saying, Davis?
Well, and so what I'm saying
is
there was a lot of misuse of energy and what they could have done better was to be as disciplined with the techniques of cycling and being better cyclists and being more efficient with cycling than with
as they were with swimming and
as were with swimming and running.
Yeah.
Right.
But what I found with the very best guys, certainly with Mark and Dave, at the time was that those guys were just phenomenal bike riders, and especially Mark Allen. I mean, you know, I've told you the story where Ray Browning would sort of tempt me to show up on a ride and put my clip-on tri-bars on, you know, and I'd go out there and I'd just keep notching it up and notching it up and notching it off and see how many people I could burn off my wheel, spending the rest of the time like glued to somebody's wheel, drafting, taking full advantage of all my knowledge of saving energy.
Right.
and these guys are out there flogging themselves. And they of course have swam for an hour, you know, or in front of the ride, and so I have all these advantages. But you know, sure enough, the one guy who would be on my wheel after I'd been rolling at 33, 34 miles an hour for 5 or 10 kilometers would be Mark, and he'd go out and ride with us in the mountains. He'd do these 6-7 hour rides, you could just see the difference there. And the difference of what his capacity was, but also his intelligence about riding, you could really see that. But I love the group of triathletes. I mean, I've always said that you guys, Paul, were some of the most generous, fun, loving, great bunch of people I've ever had the privilege to train with. And I wish cyclists could learn a lot about how to be well behaved as athletes. I mean, well-behaved in terms of, like, being inviting to people.
Right.
And being
supportive.
You know, road cyclists are like snobs.
No.
Triathletes are like, come on, yeah, sure, you can come out with us. That'd be great.
God.
And, Ray, awesome guy, and through Ray Browning, I just had the privilege of meeting Molina and Aaron Baker and Tinley and you, Paul, and... You know, Paula, everybody was fabulous.
Hey, Davis, thank you so much for staying up late out there in Texas and joining us. And we will see you at the Competitor Awards maybe one of these days again?
Yep, we'll be back this year.
Excellent.
Definitely looking forward to it. And thanks so much, guys. Enjoy the weeks ahead, and we'll see
All right.
you.
All right, thanks, Davis.